Yes, I've chosen
a slightly unusual title for this talk. It is called Rajumpa's Unusual Faith, and hopefully it will become apparent why. But I want to tell a more personal story. Now, I know some of you may have heard this story before, but as I was saying to my group the other day, I have just turned 50 a couple of months ago, and I'm getting towards that age where I can start to repeat stories, potentially. I apologise if you've heard this, but it somehow, I think it fits with the talk. Just over a couple of years ago, I attempted to get up into Tibet. I was about to return to Madhyama Loka to live with Urgyen Sangharakshita, obviously the founder of the Tri Ratna Order and community, and I was cutting down on work commitments, and I thought, well, I may as well take the opportunity to indulge my, I suppose you'd call it, fascination for that part of the world. I failed, unfortunately, due to the political situation at the time, but I did end up spending a month in Kathmandu with my good friend Jinaraja and some friends, particularly in the Bodhinath area, where there was a large Tibetan community. I've got a Tibetan friend that came with us. Actually, I'd been in Kathmandu back in 1990, so it evoked lots of fantastic memories. We had a really good time in 1990. Kathmandu's population has probably doubled since that time. So it's noisy, it's crowded, it's smelly, it's polluted, particularly in the centre, it's changed. But nonetheless, it's still a fascinating place. Kathmandu Valley was the centre of an ancient Buddhist and Hindu culture, kingdom. And you still see vestiges of that past everywhere, nearly every street corner. You see temples and shrines and chaitas and stupas that have probably been there for nigh on 1,000 years, I'd assume. Some of them have, certainly, over 1,000 years. And of course, the valley itself is dominated by two huge stupas. There's Swambhanath in the west, I hope I've got that right, and in the east, you've got Bodhinath. And according to some sources, there have been sites of pilgrimage from, well, some say before the 5th century CE. And there's still very much sites of pilgrimage, especially Bodhinath. You've got monks and you've got nuns and you've got yogis, you've got old people, you've got young people, you've got livestock all circumambulating the stupa. There's calves that go around. It's fascinating. And it's happening all throughout the day, but particularly in the mornings and particularly in the evenings. And it's a wonderful thing to participate in. You've got Tibetans, you've got Nepalis, you've got Westerners. They're all doing this. And then when you think about it, probably, at least in my imagination, I like to think so, probably Rajumpa and Marpa, having spent significant amounts of time in Kathmandu, did exactly the same. When I was there, I saw a cotton-clad yogi, probably the most impressive individual I've ever seen from a distance. He just seemed to, I don't think it was just my imagination, he seemed to just radiate something. Very impressive. So, a fascinating place. Also fascinating because you've got this profusion of imagery, Buddhist and Hindu. There's lots of shops selling bronze images, silver images, gold gilt images, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, tantric deities, Buddhist and Hindu, as well as obviously the traditional Tibetan and Nepali tanka paintings. And of course, some of the images are incredibly beautiful, hand-finished, crafted, and relatively cheap compared to what you'd have to pay in the West. So it does occur to you when you're there, you think, well, maybe I could buy a nice rupa for my shrine. It seems like a good idea, but of course it's quite difficult, isn't it? Because when you go around the shops, you see so many different qualities, different prices, and you get into this slightly uncomfortable, hesitate to call it greed thing, but it's a craving sort of thing. You think, oh, yes, maybe not. You think about it for a couple of days. I got fed up with that, and I just, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to participate. I won't bother. But a couple of days before I decided to come back home, I saw a little solid silver figure of Milarepa in the shop in Bodhinath. And I thought, That's nice. A little bit expensive for what it is. It's only a few inches high. So I bought this little figure. He's in the classic pose, as you can see from the shrine, with both Aloka's painting of Marepa and the bronze image. I don't know what this posture is. I've been looking at it. I mean, one of the things about this retreat, we've been talking and listening to talks about Milarepa and his life, but actually I seem to have connected much more with the image of Milarepa himself. This posture that seems to be sort of slightly loosened, isn't it? It's not quite the royal ease posture. It's not quite the stepping down of Tara. It's not the seven-point Virochana, Padmasana, locked posture of the Buddha. It's like a knot, isn't it, that's been slightly loosened. It's still got enough tension in it to retain the form of the posture, but it's loose enough for the energies of the body and mind to flow freely. Yeah, Milarepa is a master of the Mahamudra tradition, and this sort of yogic posture, I think, sort of exemplifies something like that. And of course, he's got his bowl. I don't know whether it's a begging bowl. It could be the bowl he uses for his nettles on one level, couldn't it? His nettle pot, yeah? On a more esoteric level, maybe it's a skull cup brimming with the nectar of immortality, Amrissa. Maybe there's a significance there. He's transcended the realms of birth and rebirth. He's gone from death, Mara, to Amara, the deathless, yeah? But I think the one thing that really has intrigued me is this gesture. I don't even know if you call it a mudra. Is he listening or is he singing? Or is he doing both? No? So he's got his hand up to his ear. Is he listening to what was called in his tradition the whispered lineage, the whispered transmission of the gurus, the oral instructions? Yeah, what they call the breath of the Dakinis, which is not only heard, but it's felt on the nape of the neck? Or is he singing his songs of realization, yeah? His songs of ultimate truth? Yeah? So, yes, I think that, in a sense, has really intrigued me, this open, receptive, attentive listening so deeply that you're going to allow the truth to radically transform your being. No, being open, being natural. It's a natural posture as well. So there's something about the yogi there. Anyway, I bought this little image. I thought, that's nice. It'll mark the beginning of a new period of my life, living with the guru, so to speak, in Birmingham, of all places. I'll install it on my shrine in Majjhimaloka to remind me of what I'm meant to be doing spiritually. Especially, as I said, Milarepa was one of my first inspirations when I came across Buddhism. So I bought it back and duly installed it in my bedroom at Majjhimaloka. And I bought various bits and pieces for Bhante, which I gave him. And he was very pleased. And then after a couple of days of getting back, I thought, oh, I haven't shown him my little Milarepa image, yeah? So I thought, well, I'll take it into his study, because the light there is better, his eyesight not being particularly good. If he's got some natural daylight behind him, he can see things better. So I said, oh, Bhante, I bought this in Kathmandu, little Milarepa. So he picked it up, and as Bhante's wont to do, he sort of turns it around slowly. He's been making some appreciative noises. And then he looks up at me and he says, thank you. He slowly stands up and he pops it on a shrine. Actually, I'm delighted to be able to give Bhante, to in a sense offer Bhante this little silver image. Albeit inadvertently, because, well, Bhante, my teacher, there's a whole variety of reasons why I might want to give him something, yeah, just out of love and deep gratitude for all that he's given me. Bhante is, after all, my precious teacher. But also, it has a strangely symbolic resonance now, given the tradition we've been looking at over the last week. In the Milarepa's tradition, in the Vajrayana, the symbolism of offerings takes on quite a radical significance. Yeah? Of course, in those traditions, the guru is given a very important place. In fact, he's seen as the equivalent of a Buddha, yeah? At least with respect to his immediate disciples. So this is the idea of the guru as esoteric refuge, yeah? Which would be a little problematic for us, I think, in our own tradition and culture. We talk in terms of spiritual friendship, Kalyana Mitrata, of course, and we can talk in terms of vertical Kalyana Mitrata. But I guess there's nothing stopping you seeing your preceptor as a Buddha. It may not be entirely fair on them, but you could do it. Yeah. As we've seen in the life of Milarepa, it was considered necessary to be prepared to give up everything to the guru for the teachings. And this is based on the ancient Indian tradition of guru dakshina. Dakshina is associated with the right-hand side in Indian tradition. You always offered your teacher something from the right. You never offer anywhere in the Indian tradition with your left hand, do you? I don't need to explain that. But it's often, there's a tradition of staying with your teacher and you offer something when you leave, and that goes down to the present day in Hindu society as well. And of course, offering gold and silver is in itself highly symbolic, isn't it? These substances represent the most precious things on the material plane. On the tantric path, if you've been offered teachings by your guru, you offer up gold, you offer up silver. As we saw from the life of Milarepa and Lama Nogpa, you even offer up livestock. Yeah, don't forget your old goats. You don't leave anything out. Yeah, there are a few mitras here. We don't go with this in the Triratna, so relax. Yeah, this is not a requirement. I mean, if you do want to convert everything to gold and silver and present it to your preceptor, that's fine. Yeah, I don't think they'd have any problem with that. Perhaps. Yeah, if you don't have a preceptor, I'll oblige. That's, you know, I'm a nice guy. Yeah. So the symbolism of this sort of offering is obvious in a way. It's not as if the Dharma is a commodity that can be bought or sold. Yeah, we're not in the marketplace. The offering gold and silver really represents or signifies a willingness to make a total commitment of one's energy and resources to the Dharma, to embark on the path of the Dharma wholeheartedly. As we've seen in the Vajrayana, this was a path where one could gain enlightenment, supposedly, in one lifetime. Yeah? Yeah? I don't know how many of them managed to do that. Yeah? That's a moot point. As Bhante has said to us on occasion, there are no higher teachings, there are only deeper realizations. Yeah. We come at it from that angle. Yeah. So we don't say, well, this is a higher path than this and this is a higher path than that, necessarily. We've got the luxury, if you like, of looking back over the whole of the Buddhist tradition. Yeah. There is no enlightenment that's quicker or higher than the Buddha in the early tradition. Yeah. So, anyway, the Vajrayana was said to be a path where you could gain enlightenment in one life. At least from that, the perspective of that tradition, it demands wholeheartedness, you can imagine. None of us are going to get very far with anything at whatever level if we're half-hearted. I assume none of us aspire to being half-hearted at anything, one would assume. You certainly couldn't accuse Milarepa and Marpa of being half-hearted, could you? Wholeheartedness also seems to imply action, doesn't it? We offer up wholeheartedly our time and energy and commitment to practice. But what does the teacher give? Well, the teacher gives the most precious thing of all, according to the Buddhist tradition. He gives the gift of the Dharma. So one's relationship with spiritual friends, especially with one's teachers, you could say, is based on this spirit of generosity, dana. You could say based on a spirit of gratitude as well, I guess. But it's a reciprocal generosity. Yeah, it's a sort of mutual generosity, receptivity, and I would argue sensitivity, no doubt. And if this is not the case, then something is obviously wrong in that relationship. I would certainly link this quality of what I'm calling wholeheartedness to the Buddhist faculty of Shraddha. I don't know whether it's a perfect fit, but there seems to be a linkage, yeah? Faith and confidence in the path. Time and time again, you see this in the Milarepa's traditions, our teachings. He prefaces his songs, his gur, as they're called in Tibetan, his spontaneous songs of realizations with wonderfully heartfelt salutations to his teacher, yeah? Verses of homage and veneration, a full heart, wholehearted expression of his Shraddha, acknowledging the profound debt that he owes to his teacher, Marpa. So, in a sense, that was by way of a bit of a preamble. Tonight, I wanted to look at Milarepa not so much as a disciple as we did in the life of Milarepa, but more as a teacher, a master, a Kalyana Mitra, as we would say in the vertical sense. And I'm hoping that by relating some stories from the text called The 100,000 Songs of Milarepa, which is no doubt available in the bookshop at a reasonable price, I would assume, I don't know, we will be able to shed some light on the nature of Shraddha and spiritual friendship in the vertical sense, and perhaps even a bit on the relationship between the two, as I say, at least within the context of this tradition. So Milarepa is guru. Guru really doesn't make any sense at all, of course, unless you have a disciple. Yeah, we need a disciple. So who better than Milarepa's heart son, the moonlight disciple, Rajumpa. Gompopa, who Mandravajra mentioned on Sunday evening, a very important disciple, is the disciple that Milarepa referred to as a sunlight disciple. Yeah. Why moonlight? Why sunlight? Maybe there's something there. I don't know. Maybe it reflects a difference in personality. But Rachumpa was a raper. He was a cotton-clad yogi. Yeah. Gompopa was an ordained monk in the Kadampa tradition that originated with Atisha in Tibet. So the two stories I want to focus on, or at least use as reference points, are the stories of the yak horn and Rajumpa's repentance, as well as excerpts from some of those stories that precede and follow up. I think these give quite a fascinating account of Milarepa's style as a teacher, which actually I think is completely different from Marpa. You get a completely different feeling for Milarepa's style of teaching than the rather rigorous style that Marpa, or even violent style at times, that Marpa adopted. Yeah? And it also gives an insight, I think, into what I interpret as a bit of a, well, not a bit of a major spiritual crisis on the part of Rajumpa, who is young but is a seasoned practitioner. Yeah? So maybe this has some relevance. Yeah? Rajumpa's character and temperament makes for a great story, and I'm sure I'm not going to do justice to that here, but at least I would say, you know, read the chapters for yourself, because really there's a lot of richness, and I've sort of swept over it in a certain way, so I just can't relate all the detail, obviously. But it's worth reading. So who was Rajumpa? Well, he was a Tibetan. Fortunately for Rajumpa, he was still quite young when he met Milarepa. He was about 11, so the tradition tells us. And even as a young boy, Rajumpa was quite talented, precocious, you could say. He was very literate. He read scriptures. His parents sent him out for income. He read the scriptures, and they got a certain amount of income. So they were quite attached to him from that point of view, and upset when he went off with Milarepa. He was quite spiritually gifted, I guess you could say, as well. So as soon as he saw Milarepa, his guru, he intuited a deep connection, yeah, and spent many years living and practicing in the company of his teacher, serving him, essentially. I like the character of Rajumpa. Yeah? He comes across as a bit of a lad at times. It's easy to relate to him. He's a very human character. You get him in the round. He's not an idealized figure. Yeah, in the life of Milarepa, for example, in that rather straight reading that I gave the other night, at least from the traditional text, you get this slightly sanitized version of the early Milarepa, don't you? He's committing evil acts to satisfy his mother's thirst for revenge, as if he's solely her agent, sort of thing. Yeah, he's actually good and he will be good, but he was just influenced. So we can't really, you know, if we want to see Miller Raper on the round, I think as Mandravedra is saying, we'd have to question that. But you do get Rajumpa in the round in these texts. He's a bit conceited, he's a bit self-willed at times, he's clearly ambitious, spiritually ambitious, maybe a bit on what we'd call the individualistic side, yeah? Quite endearing, really, I think. He certainly seems to have lots of drive and a taste for adventure, given he's been to India 3 times. First time to cure himself of leprosy. His parents gave him leprosy because they were annoyed that he went off with Milarepa, so, yeah. This is a reference back to Mandravedra's talk. The other 2 times to obtain teachings and transmissions, which Marpa had not managed to receive in his time, and so couldn't pass on to Milarepa. In fact, Rajumpa's 3rd trip to India is part of tonight's story. He also seems to have had a bit of an eye for the ladies. Mandravedra. At one stage, having gone off and got himself into trouble with a local princess, a certain Lady Dembu, yeah? Probably would have given those dove-footed nymphs a run for their money, I think. Yeah? Of course, his guru comes to his aid, but it was a close call. Yeah? So thank God for gurus. Eh? Speaking personally, there's only one occasion I can remember when Bhante's told me, Paramartha, don't do that. In no uncertain terms. Yeah? I was a lot younger then. He doesn't give me that sort of advice now. He doesn't need to. Yeah? But you can guess what it was about. It involved a woman, put it that way. When I think of Rajumpa, Bhante's aphorism comes to mind. I'm sure you know it. Better a live sinner than a dead saint. Yeah? Rajumpa, for me, is a live sinner. You can't help thinking that Milarepa, in a sense, probably, given his background, probably had an affinity for live sinners. People with a bit of energy, not necessarily bad boys, but, you know, that sort of quality. But in a way, I don't want to exaggerate this side of Rajumpa too much, because he did also become something of a live saint in the end. So we have to backtrack a little bit before telling the story of the acorn and Rajumpa's repentance. And this story only really makes sense if you go back to the chapter called The Challenge from the Logician Monks. Lakeshvara read out a reading from that sort of episode the other night. Or was it last night? Last night. So we have to remember we're in the latter part of Milarepa's life. Already Milarepa's fame has spread far and wide. Certainly throughout Tibet, definitely in Nepal, and possibly even in the northern parts of India, certainly within the Siddha and the yogic tradition, I assume. In this story, you've got this tension between essentially the monastic tradition in Tibet and the yogi tradition, the yogic tradition. The monastic tradition represented by the scholar monks, Lodin is his name, the head monk, and the yogic tradition is represented by Milarepa. And no doubt patronage was important to both parties, but as you can imagine, the yogis, being peripatetic, moving from place to place, probably weren't so dependent on patronage. Yeah? The monks would have been more so. So in Nayanam, the area where Milarepa and Rajumpa are staying, a certain amount of jealousy and tension is breaking out. It has to be said on the scholar-monk side. I don't think Milarepa's got an issue. But it's essentially a competition for patronage. So one of the head monks, a chap called Lodin, sets up a meeting and his disciples, invites them to a large gathering of monks. Milarepa's disciples come, patrons come, and all the monks from the local monastery are gathered together. And Lodin's obviously out to try and humiliate Milarepa in front of everybody and stands up at one point in the proceedings and challenges Milarepa. So he says to him, "You are an extraordinary yogi. So you must have a sound knowledge of logic. Otherwise, acting like this, you will degrade the Dharma, ruin yourself, and others and disqualify yourself as a Dharma practitioner. Therefore, please give us a simple proposition in accordance with the rules of logic. So Lodin represents here that very scholarly tradition within the monastic tradition itself, and is relying on his superior knowledge of logic, something Milarepa would not have been trained in, obviously. I showed this little statement of Lodin's to a guy, an order member who knows a little bit about logic. I just wondered whether it was in itself logically consistent. Yeah, and he said that actually Lodin's statement is a hypothetical syllogism based on what we would regard as a false assumption. I don't know what that means. But hopefully it makes the point. The science of logic was developed in medieval India and honed, no doubt, in the great debates that occurred between all the different traditions, including the Buddhist tradition, but the Buddhists and the Jains and the Hindus. And it was also taken up and developed within the Buddhist tradition itself and originated with a character called Dignaga, as far as I know. At least in some Tibetan Buddhist traditions, it is still given a very important emphasis, particularly in the context of monastic training. Certainly in the Gelugpa tradition, as some of you all know, I spent, I don't know how long ago, I think it was about 3 years ago, the Dalai Lama was in Nottingham. He did 3 days on the nature of reality. It was extraordinary. Yeah? It was a very, very fine dialectical analysis of one's experience, right down to the absolute, and it just went on for 3 days. I couldn't follow it. But it was impressive. It was impressive. It was, for me, it would have been like sitting there in the 15th century, 14th century, whatever. You would have got the same sort of approach. There wasn't a metaphor, there wasn't an analogy, it was just straight, yeah, analysis in that way. Very impressive. But of course, mistaking or confusing intellectual or book knowledge, as important as it is, for genuine spiritual experience has always been a problematic issue in the spiritual life. Bhante, of course, tells us that one of the key issues of the spiritual life is to find emotional equivalence to our intellectual understanding. Book knowledge does not equate with real spiritual knowledge. And remember, with Milarepa, of course, we're in the tradition of Naropa, the great teacher of Marpa. Naropa certainly had book knowledge. He studied at Nalanda. He left that to take up life as a yogi, a tantric yogi, a siddha. And he's confronted, isn't he, by an old hag with 37 ugly features one day as he's poring over his books. You must know the story. I won't go through it. But basically, she asks him the killer question. Okay, you understand the words, but do you understand the meaning? The paramatha. So, of course, he's humiliated and he realizes that all his time in Nalanda amounts to zilch. Off he goes, and he meets Tilopa, his teacher, who puts him through some rather rigorous trials. Yeah? Interestingly enough, this is just an aside, even in the life of Milarepa, there's a point in the life of Milarepa where Milarepa is communicated to by, I think, Dakinis or somebody, and they say, look, this style of, treat him rough is outmoded, we shouldn't really be doing that anymore. The life of Milarepa was written 100 or so years after Milarepa died. So what that points to, so that style of putting through people extreme trials, maybe it's open to abuse, obviously. Anyway, point of interest. So Milarepa, of course, is not versed in the science of logic. Nonetheless, he can think logically. He reminds Lodin that, as he puts it, being bound by the logic of jealousy and evil cravings, Milarepa is perhaps suggesting this is Lodin's problem, one is liable to experience the logic of hell and suffer the logic of pain. Which I think is brilliant, isn't it? Can't argue with that. With that, Lodin actually reveals where he stands spiritually. He picks up a handful of dirt and throws it in Milarepa's face. Milarepa, in comparison, reveals where he stands spiritually. He smiles and just brushes the dirt off his face. But of course, how does Rachumpa act? Well, he picks up a stick. And he's about to crack this High Lama Loden on the head. And just at the last minute, Milarepa grabs his arm and says, look, calm down. Yeah? And as is often the case with Milarepa, he uses the occasion to give Rajumpa and Loden a teaching in the form of a song. Yeah? It's a bit like a musical reading the 100,000 songs. It builds, it builds, it builds, and then you have this song. You know, they burst into song. You know, I can't get Sound of Music out of my head every time I read it, you know, which is terrible, yeah? Tucci, the famous Italian scholar, Giuseppe Tucci, I read the other day, actually he was quite involved in early English music right at the end of his life in the 80s before he died. He was going to set the life of Milarepa as an opera. I read somewhere. That was interesting. I was talking to Bante about that. And, Tucci used to... I won't go there because I'm going to run out of time. So Rajumpa's a bit of a hothead. Anyway, his teacher's been insulted. How would we feel? Yeah? You know? I'm not sure I'm above it, but... I've never been in that situation. Milarepa, of course, restrains him. Yeah, to cut a long story, as you can imagine, through a display of miracles and instruction, and probably by the sheer force of Milarepa's personality, he ends up converting this scholar monk, Loden, as well as several others. Rajumpa, on the other hand, is still carrying the whole business around with him. He can't let go of it. He's brooding on it. Yeah, it's obviously affecting his practice. Yeah, we find out later he's actually stopped meditating, which I think is significant. As the text says, Rajumpa was not satisfied with his victory, for he thought that the Jetson had not answered the... Jetson's an honorific title for Milarepa. The Jetson had not answered the monk's questions in a scholarly manner. The only way Rajumpa thought to himself to conquer these scholars who cannot even be convinced by the evidence of miracles is through logic and argument or by black magic and curses. Well, in a way, it's just the power mode, isn't it? You say, well, if we can't, look, you know, I'll go off to university, I'll get a degree in Buddhism, I'll come back and I'll convince these people I'm not just some navel-gazing whatever, yeah? Or you resort to the black arts and curses. Ah, scholars, what are they good for? You just abuse them, yeah? They're not good for anything. Real practice is on the cushion, yeah? You know, they're just caught up in their heads, their intellectual. Yeah. So there's that sort of tendency. Yeah. But what does Rajumpa do? He decides to go back to India. He's been there twice. He wants to go back to India to learn how to debate. Yeah. He knows how difficult going to India is, so something very powerful is propelling him. Yeah. It's going to take him years. He's going to take himself out of that sphere of his teacher's influence. Of his brethren, yeah, the yogi disciples, and he's going to go off to India. India probably represents for him the centre of the 11th century spiritual universe. One would imagine, yeah. Nalanda at the time, it's the centre of learning as far back as the 5th century, had 10,000 students and 2,000 teachers. We're on the cusp of when the Muslims invaded, only 100 years later, and eradicated Buddhism. From the Indian subcontinent. So we have to be very grateful for all those adventurous Tibetans that went into medieval India and brought back and preserved some of that tradition because it was lost in India. Yeah. So people like Marpa, for all their quirky eccentricities, I mean, they were tough guys that went in there and did something for history, at least for Buddhist history as well, I imagine. So yeah, maybe Rajumpa thinks, well, that's where the real stuff is. That's where the real spiritual stuff is, in the East. We still do that, don't we? We go, oh yeah, it's okay, but Tibet, ooh, you know, India, well, that's where the real stuff is, yeah? But, you know, it's not in their backyards, obviously, yeah? But one does suspect, actually, that's exactly where it is, and that's exactly where you should be looking for the real spiritual treasure in your backyard. Anyway, Rajumpa's determined to go off to India. Mudraku has clearly pointed out to him that he thinks it's wrong. He not only thinks it's wrong, he thinks it's worthless. He says that. Rajimpal's motivation, well, I don't know. Maybe he's a bit stuck in his practice. As I say, he's young, but he's a seasoned practitioner. This is not someone just starting out. Maybe he's hit a barrier in his spiritual life. Maybe he's having what we call a spiritual midlife crisis. I do hear it happens. Yeah? People go off and do all sorts of extraordinary things. Yeah? Interestingly, what advice does Milarepa give to a Rajumpa? Concentrate on your meditation, mate. Get on with your practice. But Rajumpa, you know, he's got this wonderfully headstrong quality to him, yeah, and he insists. So Milarepa isn't going to stand in his way. He's made his own position clear. He's clean from his side of the equation, yeah. But he says to him, look, I'm not going to send you there to study logic and magic. Forget it. If you're going to go, at least get the teachings I couldn't get from Marpa, or Marpa couldn't get from India. There's a series called the Formless Dakini Dharma series. I think they've got 4 out of 9. I don't need them, but they may be useful for others. So Milarepa gives him the gold, the means to get to India, which I think is quite interesting. Yeah, because obviously Milarepa's disciples rely to some extent on Milarepa for their support. Milarepa's giving him the opportunity to go to, and even though Milarepa's literally said, look, don't go. Yeah? It's a very different style to Marpa, isn't it?
Yes.
Actually, Milarepa says to him, this unformed son of mine, loser of debate, is full of doubts and has stopped his meditation. He's about to wander far away to study. This is the very thing a yogi should avoid. Yeah? And of course, you get the impression in the text that Rajumpa isn't listening. Yeah? He just hears what he wants to hear. The guru's given him his blessing. He's off to India, fantastic. He's obviously excited. He's a bit full of himself. Yeah, he actually picks up a piece of gold. It's a bit cringeworthy. He picks up a piece of gold, Milarepa's own gold he's given him, the best piece, and then the text says, tosses it to his teacher as a sort of a farewell offering. The cheek of it, yeah? When you read it, you get a little bit heated up. You know, you think, dear, dear, you know, a little bit judgmental. And then he says to Milarepa, he sings him a song. He says, bless me, my teacher, let me risk my life to fulfill the guru's will. Pray safeguard him wherever he goes in India, a land of danger and full of bandits. Pray lead him to the right teacher. As he wanders alone in that foreign land. There's a certain irony there, isn't there? He's living with Milarepa, and he wants to go off. He thinks, well, you know the syndrome. I think Bhante, maybe I call it the Anila syndrome. You've heard the stories of the French nun in Kalimpong. If you haven't, well, they're worth reading, going from teacher to teacher, yeah? I think there is a syndrome there, isn't it? So somehow Rajumpa's just not listening to Milarepa. He's caught up in these breathtaking rationalizations, yeah? The way he's put it, he's actually doing Milarepa a favour by going to India. Milarepa doesn't want him to go. I thought about Bhante here again, giving advice to people. I don't know whether it's actually true, but I've heard it said that he seldom gives direct advice. Unless, of course, it's someone like me who's about to do something stupid, but... because in the end, at the end of the day, people often end up doing exactly what they want to do. No? Why bother? You might be able to sort of coach them in a certain direction. But Rajumpa's in a heroic, adventurous mode. You know, he's in a mood that, you know, won't be stopped, and he's not going to stay, so off he goes. I'm not going to tell you about Rajumpa's adventures in India, but he goes through Nepal. He circumambulates the great stupas of Kathmandu, at least in my imagination. He meets up with many famous teachers. He gets all these books on the black arts, on logic and also the Dharma. And he brings back all these precious manuscripts for Milarepa and for himself. But he also brings back a gift for Milarepa, a staff given to him by a great siddha, either in India or Nepal, called Tapupa. So in this way, his mission is successful. Yeah. So we pick up the story again, the story of the yak horn, where Milarepa and Rajumpa are meeting on the Bakulu Plain in Gunthang province after what I assume to be an interval of several years. So Rajumpa has obviously journeyed up through the old trade routes from Nepal to Tibet. He's come to the plains of Gunthang and is journeying across them, heading in Milarepa's direction. Milarepa is, of course, aware of Rajumpa's journey across the plain because he has a vision. Milarepa has lots of visions in the 100,000 songs. I guess you could say that given this, his open receptivity, he's able to intuit something about Rajumpa's spiritual state, even at a distance. He knows Rajumpa. He is sensitive and he's receptive to Rajumpa's mental states, and he has the vision that Rajumpa is suffering from the poison of pride. Rajumpa, of course, is less receptive to the guru. What he's thinking is, I wonder if he's going to pay obeisance to me when I prostrate to him. I wonder if he's going to prostrate back to me. So Rajumpa prostrates himself. Milarepa doesn't move. Doesn't give the slightest indication that he's going to return Rajumpa's obeisance. It's quite funny in the text. Rajumpa's obviously a little put out. Yeah? You have to sort of read between the lines. But he goes a bit polite and formal with his teacher. Bear in mind, he hasn't seen him for years. He sort of goes into this thing about, so how's your health been? How's everybody else? So where do you think we'll be off to next? He does that rather odd, sort of casual, distancing, yeah, somehow. Milarepa's just standing there thinking, according to the text, how is it that Rajumpa has become so proud? He must have been possessed by demons or affected by the evil influence of pagans. Those dratted pagans. By pagans, I assume he means the Hindus, possibly. Yeah? Or the Jains, I don't know. No matter what the cause, I must rescue him from this hindrance of pride. So Milarepa, as Rajumpa's teacher, responds. He sees the situation for what it is. It's a temporary affliction. He doesn't need to react. He doesn't need to get judgmental. He doesn't need to get moralistic about it. He doesn't feel the need to punish Rajumpa for what sounds to us like just disrespect, I guess. He sees the situation for what it is. Rajumpa is a spiritual friend. Rajumpa's in trouble. Rajumpa's possessed by this demon of pride. Milarepa's operating from what we'd call the love mode. But he's got that objectivity that right view gives, doesn't he? He sees the whole. He takes in all the data. He sees it in the round. Rajumpa's not always like this. He hasn't been like this in the past. He's a practitioner. He's got a lot of stuff under his belt, yeah? But, you know, sometimes we do go a bit off beam, don't we? And we have to rely on our spiritual friends. If our spiritual friends just discount us and see our actions and not the person and get judgmental and moralistic, well, we're in trouble because, yeah, we need to see each other at our best, you know, in the round. So, he's operating from the love mode. He sees Rajumpa as being better than this display of pride, obviously, or of, I suppose you could almost call it hubris, as the Greeks would call it, as sort of an overweening pride, an arrogance. Yeah, there's a mula klesha called mana, isn't there? Arrogance, it's more like that. He sees it clearly. Something's obscuring his better nature. But Milarepa's mind is freed of these narrow judgmental tendencies. So Milarepa sings him a song of welcome, which I'm going to read it out. I'm only going to read a couple of songs from the text, just for time. And I'll only read part of this. But it's quite a beautiful song, I think. Remembering they've just met, Rajumpa's a bit miffed with his teacher for not returning his obeisance. And Milarepa sings, I am a yogi who lives on a snow mountain peak. With a healthy body, I glorify the mandala of the whole, cleansed of vanity from the five poisons. I am not unhappy. I feel naught but joy. renouncing all turmoil and fondness for diversion, I reside alone in perfect ease. Forswearing the bustle of this world, joyfully I stand in no man's land. Since I have left embittered family life, I no longer have to earn and save. Since I want no books, I do not intend to be a learned man. I practice virtuous deeds, I feel no shame of heart. Since I have no pride or vanity, I renounce with joy the saliva-splashing debate. Hypocrisy I have not, nor pretension. Happy and natural I live without forethought or adjustment. Since I want nor fame nor glory, rumours and accusations disappear. Wherever I go, I feel happy. Whatever I wear, I feel joyful. Whatever food I eat, I am satisfied. I am always happy. Through the Marpa's grace, I, your old father, Milarepa, have realised samsara and nirvana, the joy of ever joy fills my hermitage. This is my song of welcoming to you on your return. So he sings this beautiful song, yeah? And again, Rajumpa, he doesn't seem to be listening, yeah? He's in the grip of this reactive state of mind. He's caught up in his own conflicting emotions, yeah? I don't know what he's doing while Milarepa's singing. It's almost like he's a child. He's sitting there with his fingers in his ears going, da-da-da-da, can't hear you, sorry. You know, you get that impression from the text, yeah? There's something quite willful in it, yeah? Obviously, Milarepa's trying to reignite something in Rajumpa. Perhaps faith, yeah, in him. Rajumpa completely ignores this input. And what he does, he sings a song in return. And I'm going to read this song. I think it's wonderful, actually. It's completely self-obsessed, and it's completely inflated. It's a sort of an aria of inflation, self-inflation. I love it. Remember, this is in response to Milarepa's song. Rajumpa sang, obeying my guru, I went to India. My journey was hazardous and full of fear. I underwent great pain and toil, but the trip was well worthwhile. I saw Dipupa, the great tantric master, and met Mudgy, the great yogini. Also, I saw the wondrous patron Buddha and witnessed fulfillment of the Dakini's prophecy. I have unmistakably attained the longed-for pith instructions, those of the illuminating wisdom lamp, the wheel net of prana and the nadis, the universal mirror of equality, the lantern of the great bliss injunctions, the true words on the mirror of self-mind, the supreme form of the sun-like realization, and the self-liberation Mahamudra. I drank nectar, the essence of immortality. I received teachings on the Bardo, the pith instructions on dhyana practice, on the five gems and the symbols three. I was told how to practice the six yogas and how to win what I wanted in the world. The mothers and dakinis gathered for me all these wonderful instructions. The deities and gurus were all well pleased, and my mind united well with theirs. Like a rain of flowers, accomplishments fell on me. Heavenly food was fed into my mouth. The pith instructions were put into my hand. In farewell, the deities wished me good luck. My desires were met and success was won. Like the rising sun, my heart is bright with joy. Now I am back, my Jetson guru. Now I give you the Dakini's teachings. Please observe them, praise and serve them, the holy Dharma that I have bought by my achievements. Wow. What is that about? Milarepa, you know, he's obviously had the whole performance. You can imagine he's probably just there shaking his head, isn't he? He's just going, what does he say? He says, do not be proud and pompous, my little child, Rajumpa, whom I have nurtured from your teens. Ooh, that's got to hurt, isn't it? So even for a practitioner who's been practicing for a long time, this inflationary sort of thing that goes is dangerous, isn't it? You know, Rajumpa's quite heartfelt about how much he's achieved spiritually. He wants Milarepa to know this. In fact, he's saying to Milarepa, look, please observe these teachings. Yeah? This stuff's the real stuff, you know? But It's just water off a duck's back to Rajumpa, of course. He's not receptive. He's not listening. Sorry?
You said to Rajumpa, to Mudarepa.
Oh, sorry, yeah. So Rajumpa said to... Mudarepa said this to Rajumpa, yeah? Do not be proud and pompous, my little child Rajumpa, whom I have nurtured from your teens, yeah? So they're standing there in the middle of the plain. This is the plain. You can imagine Mudarepa and Rajumpa standing there in this vast plain, Gunthang, and something quite extraordinary happens. Mudarepa unexpectedly picks up all the books and the staff Rajumpa's brought back from India and then just takes off. He runs. It's such a weird shift in... He's just got this old yogi picking up all the stuff after this overweening prideful song and taking off. He's running full tilt across this plain. And Rajumpa is trying to keep up. And as Rajumpa is trying to keep up, he's still trying to convince him. There's a whole song about, yeah, but, you know, these teachings, they're great. You know, could you please slow down? And Rajumpa's puffing. And, of course, he never catches up with Mudarepa. Mudarepa's got this spiritual vitality which enables him to keep him well ahead of Rajumpa. Yeah? But Rajumpa's starting to flag. Yeah, Mudarepa suddenly stops. And he turns around to Rajumpa and he says something quite extraordinary, actually. He says to him, where the actual practice of the path, the Dharma, is concerned, the formless Dakini Dharmas do not mean too much. My relationship with you is much deeper and more important than the tantric staff of Tapupa. Much more than yourself am I concerned about the things you are doing. That's very direct, isn't it? O Rajumpa, do not be proud. Do not go astray. Let us go into the mountains and meditate in solitude. So he's saying, look, all that stuff you brought back from India, lovely, nice, great, fantastic, but actually it doesn't mean very much. What is important above all else is our friendship, is our spiritual friendship, is our relationship, yeah? Right at the heart of these encounters between the guru and the disciple, Mudarepa is emphasizing something so simple, friendship, spiritual friendship, Kalyanamitrata. And as we know, the Buddha said, it's the whole of the spiritual life, not half the spiritual life, the whole of the spiritual life. Even the oral instructions, those exotic oral instructions of the whispered teachings, the breath of the Dakini, is nothing other than the simple, profound communication that happens between spiritual friends, between a teacher and a disciple. It's the voice of the Dharma, yeah? The voice of deep inspiration and seeing the nature of reality. Whether you're listening or not, well, that's an entirely different matter, of course, isn't it? Yeah? But of course, Rajumpa's not listening. He's stuck. Yeah? And when we're stuck, what's the best advice? Well, the advice Mudarepa recommends to Rajumpa, of course, is go back to basics. Yeah? Mudarepa says, let's go into the mountains. Let's meditate in solitude. But, you know, doubt can get in the way. Our faith in the path can wane at times. Our faith in our teacher can wane at times. But as someone once said, what makes you so special that you think that the Dharma is not going to work for you? Yeah? Perhaps the best thing is just to get on with your practice, as Mudarepa suggests. And what could be a more effective antidote to pride, in Rajumpa's case, than spiritual friendship, Kalyanamitrata? Yeah? So Mudarepa says to Rajumpa, my relationship with you is much deeper and more important than all that stuff you brought back from India. So does this make a difference to Rajumpa, do you think? Does this incredibly direct, heartfelt communication from Mudarepa, does it have an effect? Unfortunately, not really. His condition has become rather chronic, unfortunately. He's been out of things for a number of years, and it's not going to be that easy. So Rajumpa's walking along the road, his emotions are still churning away. As the text says, had this been another guru, I would have had a good reception and most hospitably treated upon my return from India. But my guru lives in such poor conditions himself, naturally it would be impossible to expect any comforts or pleasures from him. I've been in India and I've learned many of the tantric teachings. A man like me should not practice his devotion as an ascetic, but should practice it with pleasure and enjoyment. And the text says, with these arrogant and evil ideas in his mind, strong thoughts full of infidelity towards the Jetson arose within him. So something seems to be coming up here, doesn't it? It's coming to the surface. In a way, I think Rajumpa's just given the game away here. It's not about pride, essentially. It's not about some sort of spiritual ambition, ultimately. What Rajumpa seems to be suffering from is a species of doubt, yeah? A lack of faith or shraddha in his teacher. Without faith or shraddha, without a powerfully positive emotional direction to practice, the practice is going to be very difficult, if not virtually impossible. If we don't have shraddha, we are at continuing risk of being caught in a snare of conflicting emotion. We risk remaining snared in what we know as the five poisons, the roots of all negative mental estates, mental events, greed, hatred, delusion, envy, and of course pride, Rajumpa's pride. Yeah. There's a particular type of snare that if you try and pull away from it, it tightens. Or is that the basis of all snares? I don't know. Never set a snare, but anyway. Maybe it's not a good analogy. Perhaps a better analogy would be how they catch monkeys in South India. Do you know that, how they catch monkeys in South India? Anybody here? Apparently what they do is they take a coconut, tie it to a tree, put a hole in it, bore out the insides, and they put a ball of sweetmeat in it. The monkey has got enough room to put his hand in. He grabs the sweetmeat, and of course he can't get his hand out because he's not going to let go of that sweetmeat. Oh. And he doesn't. And he doesn't, and he struggles, but he can't get his hand out. Yeah. Even when the hunter comes, and he's struggling, and he won't let go. He just won't let go. Even to the point where the hunter's just about to knock him on the head, he doesn't let go. Yeah. We need to let go. Yeah, we need to let go of these habitual states of mind, of being. Yeah, if we let go, we let go, and there is freedom. Yeah, in this tradition, if we let go, and we let go deeply enough and in the right way, there is bliss, there is voidness. Nirvanam, Paranam, Sukham, Nirvana is the highest bliss, as it says in the Pali scriptures. But of course, it sounds easy, doesn't it? Just relax. I think Bhante said something about the tantric path, just relaxing on the level of being, which undoubtedly is true. But of course, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, we've had our hands stuck in that damn coconut. So letting go ain't so easy. So Milarepa and Rajumpa are walking along the road. Rajumpa's been caught in the snare of deep, unskillful emotion and thought. And he certainly isn't ready to just relax and let go of these fixated mental states. Anyway, Milarepa being Milarepa can read Rajumpa's mind. He knows what's going on. He's very receptive. He's open. He has no trouble listening. He's got his hand to his ear. He's open. He's receptive. That open state of being. And as they're walking along, he points to a yak horn. A yak is a type of Himalayan cow, isn't it, that's adapted to high altitude. And it's lying by the side of the road. So Milarepa casually asks Rajumpa to pick it up. Of course, Rajumpa's in this sort of petulant mood, isn't he? And whenever we're in that sort of negative, reactive state, anything anybody says to us is going to be rather irritating, isn't it? So Milarepa says to Rajumpa, "Rajumpa, pick up this yak horn and bring it with you." So poor Rajumpa, yeah, you can sort of see what Milarepa's doing here, can't you? He doesn't pick it up himself for a start. He says to Rajumpa, "Look, you pick it up, this filthy yak horn lying on the side of the road." He's picking his moment, isn't he? He's thinking, right, pride, conceit, we'll see. And it works. Rajumpa thinks to himself, "Sometimes my guru wants nothing, as he's always claimed. But at others, as the proverb says, his greediness is greater than that of an old miser. After all, what's the use of this old yak horn? And he said to the Jetson, "What good can this piece of waste do us? Leave it alone." Mirarepa replied, "Sometimes these discarded things are quite useful." Which is a very irritating response to Amazon. He's not reacting. He's just going, "Well, sometimes these things are quite useful, Rajumpa." Anyway, they reached the central part of the plain, en route to a place called Drin, and the sky starts to darken. A great storm arises with violent hail, and it's all coming down. And one assumes it can certainly hail in Tibet. Big hailstones, no doubt. Rajumpa quickly covers his head, and he's in such haste he forgets to even look at Mirarepa. He's forgotten about his guru, which is significant, I think. Yeah? He's looking after himself, and, you know, it comes down and comes down, the hail, the rain. And then when it abates a bit, he looks up, and Mirarepa's gone. Can't see him anywhere. So he thinks, "I'll wait." And as he's waiting, he hears this little voice. Yeah? Since where's that coming from? And it seems to be coming from this old yak horn. Yeah? That had been discarded by the side of the road. So Rajumpa bends down and he tries to pick it up. He tries to look inside, but he can't. It seems to have gotten really, really heavy. He can't pick it up. So he bends down further and looks into it. And there's Mirarepa, as the text says, seated comfortably within, with ample room to spare, his body no smaller and the horn no larger than before, just as the reflection of a large image can be seen in a small mirror. Mirarepa says to Rajumpa, "Look, come in, make yourself at home." It's a sort of challenge, isn't it? Yeah. So Rajumpa thinks, "Well, there seems to be plenty of room in there. I'm sure I can get in." So he tries to squeeze his arm and his foot in, won't go. Tries to stick his head in, won't quite go. And there's a bit of this, and thinks, "Well, there's no way I'm going to get in there." And he's feeling quite chastened by this. Yeah? There's absolutely no way he's going to be able to do this. It's as if Mirarepa is giving Rajumpa a glimpse of something, isn't it? Something higher, something that is a bit beyond Rajumpa, something that's beyond his spiritual capacity at present. Perhaps it symbolises a more direct, non-conceptual teaching on Mirarepa's part. I don't know, I'm speculating. But it does seem from that point on in the story that Mirarepa has decided there's no point in trying to convince Rajumpa. There's no point in saying to Rajumpa, convincing him through argument or reason. Mirarepa needs to resort to a very different type of communication. So Mirarepa eventually comes out of the acorn, and lo and behold, the storm mysteriously dies down, and the sun comes out, and Rajumpa's clothing is dried out, and Mirarepa and Rajumpa, guru and disciple, continue their journey to Drin. I'm almost finished. So I think Mirarepa's found a bit of a chink in Rajumpa's armour here. And obviously he decides to drive that wedge a bit further in, yeah? Which is obviously necessary given Rajumpa's rather recalcitrant state of mind. So we're approaching this place called Drin, where some of their patrons live. Bit of comfort, yeah? I'm sure Rajumpa's sitting there thinking, "Civilization, thank God, you know. I can have a few hours away from this guy and I can go and whatever." You know, you can just sort of, you get the sense in the story, he's dying for it to get into town, yeah? So, but Mirarepa, what does he do? He says, "Look, let's go high into the mountains." And he's just saying, "Oh no, please, you know." And Rajumpa actually says to Mirarepa at this point, he says in a rather pathetic fashion, you know, in the song, "I'm very tired. My physical strength has reached the point of exhaustion. I think it's best if I go to a nearby monastery to recover my strength. Otherwise, I will not be able to travel or meditate at all." I mean, the irony is he's not meditating anyway. You know, brilliant rationalizations. "I'm too hungry. I'm too tired. I want an afternoon nap. Some chocolate would be nice. I've been working too hard. I just want to blob out in front of the TV. Yeah? Maybe I should go and see my girlfriend. I haven't seen her for a while. Or my boyfriend, for that matter." Not both, you know, anyway. He really, really wants some distraction, yeah? Big things are coming up for Rajumpa, you get the impression, yeah? Something's coming to a head. It reminds me of that old medieval story of the knight, isn't it? I don't know if you've heard this. He goes off to fight the dragon in the cave. And there are plenty of obstacles en route for this guy. But the last and most difficult obstacle of all is the urge to fall asleep just as you're getting close to the cave's entrance. A bit later on, Rajumpa seems to completely contradict himself. He says to Milarepa, "Please, Master, I'd like to go and stay in Drin tonight and meet the patrons." One moment he's tired, one moment he wants to go into Norwich. Drin. Sorry, I forgot the word. What's going on? Yeah, seems to be our old friends, doesn't it? The demons of restlessness and anxiety, sloth and torpor. But how does Milarepa respond? Suddenly he gets quite curt, actually. This is the first time he's sort of, you know, pulled one out of it and said, "Look, if you want to meditate, you come along with me. If you don't, you do what you want to do. You may do whatever you please. If you have confidence, faith, to follow my way will be sufficient. Otherwise, there will always be a need for something else." So again, he's really put his finger on it, yeah, squarely on it. It's Rajumpa's lack of faith and confidence in the path in his teacher, Shraddha. So I think it's at the root of this problem, this negative mental state, as well as his restlessness and anxiety and sloth and torpor and pride and everything that's coming out of Rajumpa. In simple terms, it's a lack of positive emotional engagement with his practice and his teacher. But Milarepa, as Bhante says in The Yogi's Joy, the guru's role is to knock the ego on the head, so to speak, not to pat it on the back. What does Milarepa do? Yeah? He says to Rajumpa, "Look, let's go into the mountains first. Let's not even tell the patrons we're here. Yeah? We'll camp here tonight. You go, fetch some water, and I'll make a fire." So Rajumpa's mind's seething, as you can imagine. But he goes off to get the water. And then something quite odd happens. On his way back to the cave with the water, Rajumpa reached a slope from where he could see below him the great delightful plateau between Botu and Jupu. He saw in the centre a mountain she-goat giving birth to a kid. Then the mother and daughter each gave birth to another kid. They, in turn, bore more kids, until eventually there were 200 of them. These wild mountain goats frisked so happily, with such innocence and spontaneity, that Rajumpa was amazed. He thought, "These mountain goats are even livelier and in many ways better than those of the Boltang." With great interest, he watched them play for some time. So, I don't know what this is. It's very strange and slightly hallucinogenic, isn't it? You know, this sort of mating goats propagating and growing, and what does that mean? You know, there's no explanation. I suspect it's a metaphor for his mind, the seething nature of his mind, yeah? This endless mental proliferation, thoughts, breeding thoughts, and out of control, yeah? There's something about his mental state, his spiritual state, which is coming into crisis. It's brewing, yeah? So Rajumpa suddenly comes to and he realizes, "Whoa, hang on a minute, what was that? I've been dallying here too long, I better get back to the cave." Milarepa is waiting to him with the campfire. But as he gets closer to the cave, he starts to smell something. Something strange in the air, yeah? Smells a bit like burning paper. Strange. Oh, no. And then, of course, the full horror dawns on him. My precious books. The books that I've risked my life to acquire from India, yeah? That I could never replace. Milarepa was burning his books. I love the way the text tells this part of the story. Yeah, the text actually says, "After a prayer, Milarepa meditated for a short time, then burned most of the books until only a few incomplete folios were left." Very direct. So a lot could be said about what's happening here, of course. But as I said, something's coming into crisis. There's something happening in this practitioner. There's a spiritual state which is ripe for whatever. With the burning of the books, something seems to snap in Rajumpa. He descends, you could say, further and further and further into anger, deep anger, resentment, and then finally almost into a state of insensibility. Yeah? What's Milarepa doing while all this is happening? Well, the text tells us that instantaneously a wondrous vision took form in front of Rajumpa. On Milarepa's head, a halo of brilliant light in the form of his teacher, Marpa, appeared as the dark blue primordial Buddha, Vajradhara, sitting on a radiant lotus throne. In radiating circles of light around the figure of Marpa, all the teachers, all the gurus of the whispered lineage appeared. Milarepa starts streaming brilliant rays of light from his body. Two brilliant suns appeared next to the right side of his head. Two brilliant moons appeared to the left side of his head. Then from his nose, rays of light of five different colours, like fine silk threads, burst forth. Beams of brilliant light started radiating from his eyebrows. As he opened his mouth, a flood of light revealed that his tongue had become a small, eight-petaled lotus of light, and a tiny sun and moon are hovering above it. And from the sun and moon stream moonbeams that shine out in all directions, fine, diamond-like letters of light. And then from his heart, a mass of brilliant light erupts. And with the thousands of streaming lights, small birds start to fly out from the centre of his chest. And Rajumpa, as the text says, putting his elbows on his knees and resting his chin on his hands, he, Rajumpa, began to hum meaninglessly. Milarepa continues to sing, and as he sings, he transforms his whole body into a palace made of light where beautiful Buddhas of different coloured lights are seated. Encircling each Buddha are brilliant gods of light with all their retinues, all under five-coloured canopies of light. And Milarepa sings, and as he sings, he performs all sorts of spectacular miracles. Milarepa continues to sing, and as he sings, he rises into the air. And as the text says, as he sang, he flew higher and higher into the sky, until finally he disappeared. Milarepa has gone. Milarepa has disappeared into the deep blue Tibetan sky, into the void. And Rajumpa. Rajumpa is completely overcome with deep, deep, fathomless remorse. And as the text says, at that moment, an unusual faith towards the jetsam burst forth from within him. He's lost his guru, his precious teacher. His precious teacher's gone to the realm of the Dakinis. Rajumpa decides to throw himself off the ridge, off the cliff face. He's lost his spiritual friend. So he decides the best thing he can do is die and vow to meet his spiritual friend in the next life. But of course he doesn't die, not literally anyway. As the text says, he crashed down on a great rock from where he saw the shadow of the jetsam. His precious teacher is still with him. He hasn't been completely abandoned. He's never really been abandoned at all. So that is the story of Rajumpa's repentance. So some of you, at least, may be wondering what happened next. Well, as with all good stories, Rajumpa, with this unusual faith towards the jetsam, comes through what seems to be this great spiritual death intact. In fact, Milarepa magically makes all his books reappear, at least the prescribed ones. And Rajumpa is delighted beyond all measure. Then, as the text says, Rajumpa thought, "So far I have served the jetsam in many ways. Hereafter I will serve him even better than before. This vow he kept and lived up to it all his life.